Hi, welcome to TestCast, a fortnightly podcast about all things related to software testing. I'm Bruce McLeod, and along with my co-host Trish Koo, we discuss testing techniques, tools, and living the life of a software tester. This is show number 6, our first interview show where we recently had a great chat with software testing legend James Bark. James, there?
Hello.
All right, so yeah. The internet's not playing. What I've done, I've just ripped myself off my Wi-Fi and hard-connected myself, so...
Yeah, well, I know my internet is amazing. That's why I love Singapore. The main reason I love Singapore is my internet is great. I just realized that I like a place based on the quality of the internet at the hotel. If it's a good internet in the hotel, then I like the place.
Yeah.
So I'm loving Singapore.
And the food's good, too.
Yes, the food is very nice. So I'm enjoying that as well. So it's good. I have a very happy client, and it's always nice to work for happy clients.
Yeah, that's excellent.
So it's great. So what can I do for you? What are we going to talk about?
Well, I think one thing which after your talk in Sydney that Trish and I were just talking about is that one thing you said to us was that, and the quote I think exactly was, the client will, they can always listen to what you, so they can hear the truth from you, or they can hire someone that will tell them what they want to hear.
Sure.
And with you, and so in the position of being an external consultant, I suppose you have the luxury to choose whether you work for a client or not.
Oh, I always have that luxury.
Which is lucky for you, I guess. So I guess.
No, it's not a question of being lucky. It's a question of being assertive. Look, when I worked for Reliable Software Technologies as a consultant, I at one point decided I wasn't going to work with a client anymore because I concluded that they didn't need me. And my bosses said, well, you can't just decide that a paying client is, you know, you're not going to work for a paying client. And I said, of course I am. That's exactly what I'm going to do. And they said, no, you can't do that. And I said, yes, I can. So they put me on corrective action, and I said, screw you, I quit. And that's when I started my own consulting company. If you're willing to quit, if you're willing not to surrender your integrity, your professional integrity, then that's up to you. And I can tell you that Jonathan Cole has done what I've done. Ben Simo has done what I've done. There are a handful of people. Kem Kaner's done this. There are people that I know by name who've also gone through this situation where you're put into an ethical quandary, and that's when you find out what your priorities are. And when I quit RST, I had no money. I didn't even own a computer. My computer was owned by my company. I had to pay back a $30,000 sign-on bonus because I only stayed 6 months instead of the 2 years I was supposed to stay. It took me 7 years to pay that back, but I did it. To me, it's not negotiable. I am not going to be a fake tester. If somebody wants to hire me to do fake testing, I'll say, I'm sorry, that's not the business that I'm in. So I think we all could do it. It's just a question of what our priorities are. And obviously, if your priorities are different. I have to say this. I was the sole breadwinner for my family, and I had a house payment to make. But I had a belief that things would work out okay. But I'll also tell you something else. That wasn't the major thing. It wasn't that my wife felt that things would work out okay. She really had a strong belief about that. For me, what I know about myself that other people only suspect is that I have a temper problem. I know that I will throw a chair through a window without that much provocation. So I have to protect people and protect myself from being arrested by not putting myself in a position where I feel cornered. So I was getting to that point that angry people sometimes get to, where you start having anger fantasies. You start, you know, fantasizing about taking somebody and throwing them up against a wall and getting right in their face and say, "Try me." And that's then other phrases like that that you get from Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Well, I was getting to that point, and I realized that is a very thin ice situation for me. So actually, it was a rather easy decision. It's a tougher decision for those of you who actually have the ability to get along with others. Where for you, it's a choice. For me, I don't think it's as much of a choice, or it's a very easy choice for me to make. Because I don't want to hurt somebody, lose my temper, and hit somebody. You know, I don't want to do that.
Is it an emotion based thing for you? I mean, how do you know when it's time to cut loose?
Well, it's when I start having anger fantasies. I think that's the early warning for me, where it's in the red zone. That's when I start having these feelings like, oh, I would just love to punch him. And as soon as I have that feeling, I know I have to stop. I have to get out of that situation. I have to change the situation. And I'm good at this. I mean, I have not actually punched anyone at work ever.
Glad to hear you.
Excellent.
I have not since I've 18. Since I was 18, have I really lost my temper in a violent way. And I have gotten into shouting matches with people. But I know enough about myself to know it's like, you know, someone who's an alcoholic might be sober for 20 years, but they know that they could have a problem if they get in the wrong situation. And I'm like that. I know that I know what my limits are, and I have to protect myself from and other people from getting into those situations. So it might look like it was a very courageous thing what I did, but when you have a condition like mine, it's not so courageous. It's just like a basic decision that you have to make. And I knew my wife would understand, so I didn't talk it over with her first. I just quit and went home. And Lenore knows me, and she knows that I can't work in certain situations. So she said, oh, don't worry. The angels will fix everything, because she believes in angels. And I'm a tester, and I don't believe in angels, but I'm glad that I live and am married to someone who is not a critical thinker, because I didn't need critical thinking at that point. I needed support, and she really poured on the support, so it was great. And then it was just like she said, the next week I got an offer for a big project at Microsoft. As soon as they found out that I was free, I was starting to get offers. And Kem Kaner referred business to me, and I was off and running, and I've been independent ever since. And so now it's easier for me to say no to a client. It's quite easy. I remember a couple of years after I went independent, I went on a government project, and it was like being a Martian. It's like visiting another planet, because everybody there was really afraid to lose their job, or really they had to play the game, and they were all talking about playing the game. And I felt like, you know, if I lost this job tomorrow, I would just shrug. I mean, I really don't care. I would like to make some money. I would like to do a good job. But if it's not this, it'll be something else. And so I resigned that job after 3 weeks when I was asked to do a completely unnecessary document that everybody on the team knew was unnecessary. And the only reason we were doing it is some process group on another floor in another building decided that, well, you have to follow this process because we say so. And I said, well, no, I don't do that. Look, if that's what you want, hire someone for a fraction of what you're paying me, because you can hire anybody out of McDonald's and pay them a dollar more than they're making at McDonald's, and I'm sure they will write anything, type anything that you tell them to type. What you want from me, if you're going to pay me what you pay me, is you want technical judgment, you want the benefit of my experience, and if that's not a fit for you, then I'll go somewhere where that's a fit. I want to enjoy my work. So I don't have a I have some sympathy, but not a whole lot, for a tester who says, I'm weak and helpless, I can't do anything, I have to do what I'm told. I'm working for a client right now who's a director at a major bank, which is a very high-level. Directors at banks are very high-level people. They're above vice president. And he, I love this guy because he told me, I don't understand why testers in my group, and he has 800 testers working for him. He says, I don't understand why testers in my group say people are ignoring testing. People don't respect testing because people don't ignore me. people never ignore me. I make people pay attention. It has always been true when I was a test manager, when I was a tester. If people are ignoring you, it's because you are not being relevant to them, and you better be relevant to them. You better figure out what they need, and you better work with that. But if you're being ignored, it's your own fault.
Yeah.
And so, I kind of like that attitude.
Yeah.
So, James, do you mind if I challenge that for a second?
You can challenge me anything you want.
Okay.
Challenge away.
So I think you have the luxury of it being very black and white.
It's not a luxury, man. I just told you I paid a price for
okay,
my point
bad,
of view.
Bad choice,
don't
of, bad
you
choice
tell
of words.
Me it's a luxury.
Bad choice
I
of words.
I paid the price. If you want to pay the price, you can pay the price. It's not a luxury. You know what it is? It's a luxury if you don't have to pay the price.
Okay.
I pay a price for the position that I take. What I'm trying to tell you is it's a price that many people can afford to pay. They just don't want to because they are frightened.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Completely agree. Bad choice of words on my part. The point that I was trying to make was I think if you're experienced as a tester, it's probably easier for you to know those situations. And what I was more thinking of is for someone who is starting out in testing or relatively junior or may not know, do you have some advice more on how they can challenge and question as opposed to the...
Sure.
Yeah, I was talking to
Aaron Hodder about this. Aaron Hodder is a tester in New Zealand who tweets a lot and has a nice blog. And he was asking me about this. He said that he was being asked to do some automation that he thinks is probably a bad idea because he's read Michael Bolton's blogs and read my blog, and he said, I believe what you're saying, and they're trying to tell me to do stuff that you say is a bad idea, except I've never done it before, so all I can say is, well, James Bock says it's wrong. So my advice to so he doesn't have the experience, right? So my advice to him is to warn his client about how and why it might not work, and then go ahead and do it and watch carefully what happens. So what I expect from someone who is not so experienced is that they can be sensitized. I'll try to sensitize them to warn them about certain things. And then, you know, go ahead and get experience with that. Try to count test cases and see for yourself what I'm talking about. I think counting test cases is a boneheaded, silly thing to do. However, I did it for 5 years before I realized it was a boneheaded, silly thing to do. And I'm a smart guy, and I'm a thoughtful guy, but it just never quite hit me how silly it was until a certain day, July 12th, 1992.
Not that you remember.
19 years ago.
Yeah, and then I guess you've got your own story, which is going to add more weight behind your words when you try to warn people in the future.
Exactly. You see, I don't think that you learn very well from anyone else's experiences. I think what you can get from other people's experiences is you can become sensitized. You can become warned. And, of course, if it's a life or death experience, then you better learn from it. You know, I fly airplanes, and I definitely pay attention to pilots who got killed flying airplanes and try to learn from their mistakes so I don't have to actually do them myself.
Yeah.
But for a lot of things, and test automation is this kind of thing, GUI test automation, it seems like it ought to be a good idea. And you need the richness of your own experiences so that you can really feel conviction about it. So what I try to do with my son, what I try to do with people who work for me, is I try to create opportunities for them to do things in ways that I predict will fail, but I hope that they will have enough of a powerful experience with it, even if it's on a small scale, that they won't have to spend 6 months and $100,000 of the company's money to have that experience. You know, for instance, my boss at Borland in 1991 purchased for his team, including me, a $100,000 test tool, which was a piece of junk. It was called TestRunner. It was Mercury's early product. It was before WinRunner, and it was terrible. And if he had just consulted with us in the team, we would have told him that it probably wouldn't work for us. But he just sort of surprised us with this gift one day that he had purchased these special machines, these special software. And so we tried to use them. It's kind of like wearing the socks that grandma gave you. You try to do it. Except they're $100,000 socks, so if you don't wear them, you get yelled at. And so, to his credit, after a year of trying, he let us stop working with this, and we basically threw the tool away and gave up on it. It was buggy. There were so many limitations it had, and the very nature of GUI test automation is just it's brittle and it keeps failing. And we tried and we found that it failed for us. Now, you know, that's a $100,000 mistake that he made, plus not counting all the labor of trying to use this tool. And I wish he hadn't done that. And I don't think it was necessary to spend all that much money to demonstrate that we would have these problems. We could maybe have done a pilot project and not bought the site license, or, you know.
There was a key principle we had when I worked a couple of jobs back at a financial institution at AMP in Australia, and the adage we had was fail but fail fast, and that's right. That it's okay to fail, it's not wrong to fail, but if you're going to do it quickly and learn from it and move on and then succeed.
Yeah, I took that attitude about dating years ago. I didn't want to find out, a year down the road that somebody wasn't compatible with me. So I was pretty hard on people right at the beginning. And, my relationships didn't last long until Lenore showed up.
Efficient.
So it's interesting. So I think there's lots of things coming to my mind from those comments. The first is that it sounds like you just added or maybe have started the foundation of the big pile of test automation software that has been bought and then sort of half used and then discarded as shelfware.
Oh yeah, I mean we experienced that in 91, but at Apple Computer we were developing all our own tools, so we didn't experience the buy an expensive tool and find out that it has all these limitations problem. But Mercury was starting to sell its tool all over the industry back then, and the way they sold their tool is they would try to keep knowledgeable testers out of the room when they were doing demos.
No, you're kidding.
They would do demos to people who would know nothing about test automation. And that's how they made $1 billion.
Wow.
So I always think that automation, particularly record and playback, to me I think it's almost like the gateway drug, and that it's the feature that every automation tool has to have to sell the tool to non-technical testers.
Right.
And it's just to completely ignore the real issues that go along with upskilling and actually educating and learning about automation.
Well, it's about all they can really charge money for, isn't it? I mean, the rest is just a set of libraries which you can get for free so often these days that they've got to build something that they can actually charge for on top of that, right?
Yeah, isn't that amazing how much free stuff there is out there? I to this day have not used Quality Center. I have not used Windrunner ever in my whole career. I used Test Runner a little bit, but mostly it was people working for me trying to use it who gave up on it. I don't use commercial tools. I use Perl. I use a very few commercial tools that I think are pretty cool. One of them is BB Test Assistant, which is a $200 tool. But I don't use anything that costs thousands of dollars or requires a fancy site license. Unless you count VMware, as a test tool. But, I mean, that's obviously, virtual machines is a whole different kettle of fish.
So I think the commercial tools definitely have their place. I know personally I'm definitely of the personal attitude as you. I think most of the tools that I've used in the past, I've either been augmenting commercial tools to plug holes where they wouldn't work the way I wanted, or building my own tools and my own automation libraries.
Yeah.
But one thing I noticed in my talks when we talk about people, particularly people who haven't grown up being technical testers, they're more from the business side or come into business analytics and don't have a strong coding background, there is a real reluctance to want to take ownership of actually writing their own tools and skilling up, and because I suppose they think their time should be spent, actually testing as opposed to building tools.
Well, they don't always.
But the weird thing is they have to do a lot of tool building even if they buy a tool, because.
Yeah. True.
I helped the SEC test their auction system years ago, about 10 years ago, and they were using Windrunner, and their Windrunner tool couldn't do the kind of automation they wanted to do. I took 24 hours. I wrote a thing in Perl to do a smoke test of their one part of their system. I showed it off triumphantly, after one all-night coding session. I said, look at this. It's a free tool, and look at all the things we can do with it. And their management responded by saying, can Windrunner do this? And the answer is no, it couldn't, because there wasn't a technology they were using that Windrunner kept barfing on. So what they decided to do is fire their Windrunner guy and get a new Windrunner guy. I said, well, what about Perl? And the guy said, we don't have anyone who knows Perl. But the thing is, you don't have anyone who knows Windrunner. Windrunner it's the same thing. It's a technical skill to make Windrunner work. It's a technical skill to make Perl work. The difference is there's no site license for Perl. Get this through your thick heads. The reason why you want to stick with Windrunner is you're embarrassed to say that you wasted your X $100,000 on a site license for a pile of nothing. And that's embarrassing. So you don't want to admit that you were wrong, and that's why you want to do this, isn't it? And they said to me, oh, no, that's not the reason at all. But it was just transparently obvious that that was the reason. If they're firing their Windrunner guy and getting a new one because they think he doesn't have the skills, then they might as well fire the Windrunner guy and hire someone who knows how to use the free tools and work with that. The thing is, you have power, you have control over your tool if you develop it. If you don't, if you buy it from Mercury or HP, you have to pay every year. You have to pay through the nose.
Yeah.
You're paying anyway.
So
I think it's a silly bargain. It's a ridiculous false economy.
So one thing I've noticed in my own automation is that the amount of abstraction layers that I put on top of what I use an open source, for web-based stuff, I use an open source engine called Watton or a library that I wrote myself on top of Microsoft's UI automation library. And what I found is I've completely abstracted the automation away. So my stack, it's pretty much, for control, it's broken down to get value, set value, click, or not even click, invoke, and then the stack just works out what sort of control it's talking to and completely abstracts that. And so then what I found is that the actual tool itself is just a commodity, and I would get no value over $30,000 commercial tool versus an open source one, because it literally is an engine that's just like, it's literally just a library that I call that I can just unplug and plug something else in.
It's a set of libraries, and you've just built your own product right on top of it, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true. And if that's the case, then fine. I also have another thing, which is I'm offended that I'm giving money to a company that wants me just to give more and more money to them. I'd much rather give no money to ActiveState and download Perl. Although I'm actually happy to buy things like their developer's kit and their debugger and things that make it easier for me to program in Perl. I feel like I'm fine by purchasing that stuff. But that's not many, many thousands of dollars. But, and also, here's another thing. A lot of those commercial tools, you have to pay for every machine you want to use it on.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that kind of crazy nonsense is that? Every machine? What? They're just trying to make you pay through the nose for your testing. And that means that's less people that you can pay for. That's other tools you can't buy. I'm offended by that. And so I hope that the tool vendor industry just dries up and dies. And I hope they all are thrown out of work and they can't feed their children and their children won't know where their bones are buried. I think that it's terrible.
Yeah, I agree. It's horrendous.
They're leeches on the industry, most of them.
I think that's very fair, but I think if you look at some companies like Atlassian, their pricing model for their defect tracking tools, I think, is very reasonable. You know,
I don't know about their pricing model, but I like them as a company. So, I met some people at Atlassian, and I like their corporate values anyway.
So the licensing really is from 0 to 10 users is free, and you can have a server with an unlimited site license for about $3,000.
Well, that's pretty reasonable.
So it's a sort of a – and don't quote me on that. Go to Atlassian.com if you want to confirm. But
I like Atlassian, so I'll exempt Atlassian from the dry up and die curse.
Yeah, but the dynamic testing
that I just put on all – my reckless curse that I just put on all tool vendors, I take it back. There are some tool vendors that I do admire, a handful of them. I like the Hexawise guy who does Hexawise, Justin Hunter.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
I like him, and he has, I think, a very progressive mindset, and I hope he makes lots of money on his tool because he also lets people use it on a small scale. He lets individual testers work with it all they want. It's only, for large-scale usage that he starts charging serious money. And I've tried his tool out, and I think it's a pretty nice tool. It's easy to use. I'm impressed with it. And so he is the only – Justin Hunter is the only tool vendor who has been invited to speak at CAST, at the CAST conference.
Yeah.
And that's where we will leave part one of our chat. In our next show, we continue the conversation and discuss the effectiveness of pairwise testing. If you're new to the show and want to find out how we got here, you can find past episodes and leave any comments at hestcast.net. Thanks for listening.